plants with feather-like leaves against a backdrop of soft sunlight.
66 million years ago, planet Earth was very different from today.
A rat-like mammal with brown, white-striped fur.
Back then, one of our closest ancestors might have looked something like this little furry creature.
The computer creation, which has black fur around its eyes, pads along a branch in a forest. Then it hops down onto a snoozing dinosaur's head, prompting it to stand.
The rulers of the land were giant reptiles.
The dinosaur shakes its head and the mammal leaps down onto the forest floor. The bipedal dinosaur, which has a long, thick tail and short arms, is now at the edge of a body of water. David Attenborough's standing on the other side watching it. He looks away.
Dinosaurs. That's one of the most infamous, a carnivorous T-Rex. And just behind are the bison of that time, a common plant eater, Edmontosaurus. But what happened to them all?
66 million years ago, an asteroid hit the Earth. And scientists think that it was this collision that wiped out the dinosaurs.
But no one has ever found direct evidence of that. In fact, no one has ever found the fossil of a dinosaur that died within 1,000 years of the impact. However, a remarkable dig site promises to change that.
It's in the Hell Creek Formation in the American Midwest. These badlands are rich in prehistoric remains. From triceratops,
winged reptiles,
to pterosaurs. And here, one patch of land about the size of a football pitch is yielding a collection of astonishing fossils. The precise location is a closely guarded secret, because this place may hold evidence of one of the most dramatic events in all the 4.5 billion year history of our planet.
At the dig site.
All right, get down here between you.
For 10 years, a paleontologist and his team have been trying to find out exactly what happened here.
You're at the edge of your seat every moment trying to dig this stuff up. It's like trying to defuse a nuclear weapon while you're in a rainstorm.
He's named the site Tanis and believes it could be a mass graveyard of creatures that were killed in the catastrophic asteroid strike.
A reconstruction of the asteroid impacting the Earth.
A site that could reveal not only how the last dinosaurs lived, but how they died.
If the dig team is right, Tanis could be a place where the remains of a long-lost world are frozen in time. A place that gives us, for the first time, an unprecedented window into the lives of the very last dinosaurs.
A surge of water and a burning forest.
And a minute-by-minute picture of what happened on the day the asteroid hit.
Dinosaurs, the final day, with David Attenborough. Hell Creek Formation, North Dakota, USA. A 4x4 drives along a straight dirt road, cutting through a vast stretch of arid land dotted with trees.
This landscape is full of fossils dating from the late Cretaceous, the period which began around 100 million years ago and ended 66 million years ago when the dinosaurs vanished. Paleontologist Robert De Palma wants to find out more.
I think anybody who has ever liked dinosaurs in the past, or still does, has thought at one point or another, well, what happened to them? Why are they not here anymore? So many different theories are out there, and nobody has a tight answer to that question.
Robert passes a line of trees.
Judging from fossil evidence, this is what Hell Creek looked like in the late Cretaceous.
A river bordered by dense forest.
There were low-lying marshy floodplains, intercut by river channels, and covered with horsetails, ferns, and trees. Back then, it was warm and wet here all year round.
Tanis lies in the northeastern corner of the Hell Creek Formation. Instead of today's dusty prairies, there were sandy riverbanks. Instead of rocky cliffs, there were forests. And instead of the life we know today, well, Robert is hoping to find out more about what that was like.
A pale golden stretch of sand by a river.
A sandbank lying between a river and a forest would one day become what Robert now calls Tanis. He and his team have been digging here since 2012.
So somewhere from between there and down here is where that came from. Wouldn't it come from up above? What?
Look.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And what they found is unexpected.
Here we've got this freshwater environment of the Hell Creek Formation, and this shocking red-green color is coming from the shells of ammonites, a marine organism, kind of like a coiled snail in appearance. So we've got this marine organism that's been thrown up into this freshwater environment, and they do not belong here.
How they got here is a mystery. And there's more.
I'm just going to go ahead and plane down some of this rock.
Sitting just above the ammonites is something that many dinosaur hunters are desperate to find.
So this orange layer right here is composed 100% of impact-related debris that is enriched in iridium.
Iridium is an element that's rare in the Earth's crust, but it's common in asteroids. The layer it's in is called the KPG boundary.
The team are carefully digging through small sections of dirt.
Really?
It's made up of dust and debris from a huge asteroid impact.
Look at that.
That's amazing.
Yeah. That's what we want. Okay, so it's coming from this area here, so somewhere within that region is where these pieces are coming from.
The boundary separates the age of the dinosaurs from the age of mammals. So the rocks here come from about the time that the dinosaurs became extinct.
No rattlesnakes.
What makes the site even more exciting is the rock layer right beneath the boundary where Robert found the ammonites.
The rock here is really not quite rocky as you would expect dinosaur bones and things to be encased. You expect really, really hard rocks and jackhammers and things like this, but it's very, very crumbly and it just falls apart in your hands.
As well as being crumbly throughout, this layer of rock is also around a meter thick, which, along with other unusual features, makes Robert think that something very strange must have happened here.
Murky, turbulent water.
Maybe a flood or a mud flow, burying anything within it in an instant.
Oh, there's a beautiful. Look at that one. Beautiful.
This could mean that anything he finds in this lair would have been quickly entombed, like the bodies in the volcanic ash of Pompeii.
Robert knows from the geology that anything he finds at Tanis will be tantalizingly close to the end of the age of the dinosaurs and could be so well preserved that it could reveal new evidence that would bring this time period to life in a way no one has ever done before.
Robert walks across the dig site.
Robert digs at Tanis each summer, the only time the weather allows him to do so.
Come on down, check out this lens over here. In order to understand how the impact affected life on Earth, you really need to get a very clear picture of what the world was like right before. That is a critical part of the story.
Paleontologists Dr. David Burnham and Lauren Gurchie have been digging with Robert for years.
Robert picks up a small piece of brittle rock.
Oh, wow. See the brown?
Yep.
That might be a tubercle right there.
And it seems today is their lucky day.
Oh, my God, look at that. Look, the scales are preserved.
They're like doing a freaking dissection.
Oh, my God.
The biology of tailors.
Oh, the scale. Look, the wrinkles continue down that way.
It's all nice and wet so far.
The scales are getting smaller in that direction. How big are they there?
I got a one with the projection over here.
What?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Little. Yeah, there's the protuberance right there.
I've only seen that on one other specimen.
Oh, on life.
Yeah.
This is the closest thing to getting to touch a living, breathing dinosaur.
It is.
They found something extraordinary.
It is so exceedingly rare, a piece of Triceratops skin in the Hell Creek Formation.
It may look like an impression in the rock, but this is skin that has been fossilized. And over millions of years has turned to stone. Triceratops bones are relatively common finds in Hell Creek. But skin in such condition as this is very rare indeed. The size and the patterning of the scales, together with the age and location of the rocks where it was found, strongly suggests that this is from a Triceratops. The brown colour contains traces of organic material, so it might even be possible from this to work out which pigments were in it. Finding and studying such well-preserved fossils as this helps paleontologists build a much more detailed picture of how these creatures lived. Combining this information with insights from scientists around the world makes it possible to speculate about what life in the late Cretaceous might have been like.
A Triceratops, which has two large horns on the top of its head and a smaller one on its snout.
We know from bones that adult Triceratops could reach 9 meters in length and 3 meters in height.
It's on a sandbank.
Marks on the fossil also show us that this one was badly scarred.
It's now plodding through the forest, its leathery, scaly hide and the bony collar-like protrusion behind its head dappled with sunlight.
Triceratops were plant eaters. Other fossils tell us that they had sharp beaks and hundreds of teeth that enabled them to shred tough plants such as these cycads.
Having stopped to feed, it carries on across the lush greenery carpeting the forest floor.
Almost all adult Triceratops fossils, including Robert's, have been found on their own. So it's possible that the adults were solitary, like modern-day male rhinos. So they were probably territorial, chasing rivals away.
A Triceratops standing with its rear positioned in front of a tree.
And perhaps marking their territories.
Urine splatters the tree's trunk.
If you weigh more than an African elephant, there's not much that can bother you.
The rat-like mammal.
Except perhaps a little mammal.
It drops down from a tree branch, lands on the Triceratops' rump, then leaps to the ground when the dinosaur emits a low roar. David's sitting at a table in a darkened room, looking at small fossilized bone fragments by lamplight.
Robert found these jaw bones in a fossilized burrow at Tanis. The shape of this tiny bone and tooth means it's most likely come from what's known as a pediomyid, an early mammal, and a type of marsupial.
The computer rendering of the mammal.
Robert also discovered fossilized nuts and seeds in the burrow. So we have an idea about what it might have eaten.
David's now standing at the edge of a forest in the ancient prehistoric world.
Robert's finds
are adding to our knowledge of the complex world at the very end of the late Cretaceous. And it's not just the fossilized creatures. If you walk on damp sand, you'll leave a trace behind.
He takes a step.
A footprint. The same was true 66 million years ago. And very, very occasionally, such traces were preserved. And that's exactly what happened here at Tanis.
You know, we won't foil a backside.
Right, we'll just put plaster right on. Right on. That
way you've got... Robert has discovered a number of footprints.
Yeah,
let's see.
Looks like a good print.
Yeah.
They're making a plaster cast.
Their shape gives him a clue as to what might have made them.
A clawed, talon-like foot.
If he's right, they were made by a winged creature that might well have liked a small mammal for lunch.
The pediomyid scrambles into a hole between the roots of a tree.
The footprints are long and narrow with four toe prints. Two are slightly longer than the others. And that suggests they were made by... a pterosaur.
One flies. It has a disproportionately large head compared to its body and a beak that tapers to a sharp point.
Pterosaurs are not dinosaurs, but flying reptiles on a different branch of the evolutionary tree.
A group of the winged reptiles perching on an island-like rock formation surrounded by forest. The skin of their wings is thin and is connected to both their slender arms and their legs.
Male pterosaurs usually had crests, while females didn't. So crests may have been used in courtship displays.
As it's gliding over a stretch of forest with a male, a female banks left and flies along a river.
And we have an indication of where females laid their eggs, because evidence suggests one pterosaur laid hers in the soft, sandy banks of the river at Tanis.
The female lands on the sand feet first, then drops down onto all fours, folding its wings. Back in the darkened room, David's studying a small fossil embedded in a rock.
And this is a fossilized egg of a pterosaur that Robert found there.
The only one ever discovered in North America. If you look at it with the naked eye, all you see is a jumble of lines. But if you examine it with the latest technology, you can find out a wealth of information, from the chemistry of the bones to the composition of the shell. And that, in turn, can tell us a lot about how these incredible creatures lived.
A wide door rises up, and Robert comes into a building.
Robert has been given access to the Diamond Light Source Synchrotron in Oxfordshire. It's a very powerful research tool that acts like a giant microscope. By accelerating electrons in this huge ring, the synchrotron creates beams of light many times brighter than the sun.
Robert places the egg fossil in front of a light-emitting device.
Robert and paleobiologist Dr. Victoria Edgerton now want to turn that beam onto the egg fossil to discover more about its chemical makeup.
We're pretty much lined up on the skeleton, but we might have to move the stage a little bit to get to the right part.
Sure.
Meanwhile, Robert can reveal the creature inside.
And this... who made this wonderful thing?
I got replicas of the bones from inside that egg, and I restored the remainder and put together what the skeleton would have looked like when it hatched. That's how big the creature would have been outside the egg if it had hatched.
So this is the baby. How big was it going to grow?
These very long neck vertebrae here are what really gave part of the story away to us, because those long bones match very, very closely with the Asdarchid pterosaurs. That is the giant pterosaurs.
Oh, they were the whoppers, weren't they? I mean, what, 25 feet wingspan?
Some of them. This probably had a wingspan maybe 15 feet, 5 meters.
Well, it looks as though it could take off, really.
It's easy to picture something like that just hatching out of the egg and fluttering out almost like a little bat.
Victoria's sitting at a computer.
They've scanned the egg here and in America. Victoria has the results.
So what have you learnt from the cyclotron image?
What we have here is a chemical map of calcium directly within the bones of this animal. That tells us that these bones were already hardened, so it might be ready to fly not long after it hatches.
Okay. Can you see any sign of the shell? And what sort of shell was it?
We can. What I can show you is we can see the rim of the egg in sulfur.
Does that tell you whether it was a hard shell or a soft shell?
We have been looking at this. We can see folding occurring and this unusual undulation. If it were a hard egg, we would expect splintered bits and broken bits, just like a chicken egg. This helps to tell us that it was soft.
So it was perhaps like a turtle?
Absolutely.
That's not the case, is it, with dinosaurs? Many dinosaurs led hard-shelled eggs.
Yes.
So this is a new discovery about Aztarchid pterosaurs.
Absolutely. This is something that we are confirming for the first time.
Huh. That flying pterosaurs had eggs like turtles.
Yes, much more reptilian-like than bird-like. And that can potentially tell us more about the environment in which these eggs were laid.
How interesting. Yeah.
A pterosaur winging its way over forest, its form silhouetted against the low sun.
Creatures that lay soft eggs tend to bury them in order to protect them.
A tranquil stretch of river.
So, female pterosaurs probably looked for places like Canis to lay their eggs, because the sandy soil here is just soft enough for the hatchling to dig itself out. Now the pterosaur just has to make sure that the hole is perfect.
The pterosaur digs with its beak, then rears up onto its legs and flaps its wings. A close-up of the underside of the pterosaur, which is now positioned over the hole, as a white elliptical egg slowly slides out of its body and drops into the hole.
Success. But it's not over yet. Pterosaurs had two ovaries, and they laid their eggs in pairs.
Now, in the computer-generated world, David's standing at the base of a tree when the pint-sized pediomyid pads over.
Here, on the sandbank, sandwiched between the river and these glorious trees, life at Tanis seemed to be thriving. Whoops! Never a dull moment. But all that was about to change.
A glowing, pale orange mass pulsating in darkness.
The chain of events that led to the extinction of the dinosaurs began in the distant past, deep in space.
An asteroid.
Most scientists think it all started in a ring of dust, rocks and debris known as the asteroid belt. It's usually an uneventful place. But it's thought that many, many millions of years ago, a rock was bumped into a new orbit.
The distant sun.
And diverted onto a collision course with planet Earth.
Earth's curvature, the sun giving it a glowing blue aura. Now an aerial view of the Tanis site, which is a deep, irregularly shaped pit.
Robert is building a vivid picture of late Cretaceous life at Tanis. And the team have found some more well-preserved footprints.
So these are animals that were actually walking in the water?
These guys would have been essentially on a mushy riverbank going down to drink at some point. You know, animals tend to congregate around the rivers.
This print is 30 centimeters long.
So I think this is from a type of dinosaur that we call a duck-billed dinosaur. And they would have been very common in the Cretaceous. They ate the plants in the area, and they got very large, 30 feet long.
And there are more.
This track, you see all the toes are very well preserved. You even see a nail print at the tips of the toes. So the little toenails dug into the mud. I love this one.
With David.
This is Robert's prize footprint. It has three toes, and it's longer than it is wide. So it's very likely to be a carnivorous dinosaur. It's so well preserved that you can see the mark left by its sharp claw there. Hell Creek is well known for one carnivore in particular, T-Rex. This footprint is too small for an adult T-Rex, but it's possible that it was made by a young one.
A young T-Rex pursuing a pediomyid through the forest. Then David examining a large pointed fossilized tooth.
Robert also found this at Tanis, the crown of a tooth. Its shape and its serrated edge are indications that it comes from an adult T-Rex.
As it scampers away from the young T-Rex, the pediomyid passes through the wide legs of an adult. It stops and stares up at the dinosaur for a few moments, then scurries off. The adult takes a menacing step forward and lets out a low growl, causing the young T-Rex to back up.
Bite marks found on T-Rex bones show that they ate other T-Rexes. And a youngster would make an easy catch.
The young T-Rex darts into the undergrowth.
But not this time.
The adult stares after the young T-Rex, then slowly turns away.
Very few footprints are preserved as fossils in Hell Creek. So if you find several in one place, as Robert has done, it's a reasonable assumption that there would have been many more nearby.
Gliding over forest.
And that supports the idea that dinosaurs and pterosaurs were thriving at Tanis shortly before the impact.
A T-Rex chases a small bipedal dinosaur onto a sandbank.
And if they were thriving, they must have been reproducing.
Avocado green eggs, half buried in the forest floor, in a circle.
Fossils from dinosaurs similar to T-Rex show they may have laid around 20 eggs in a circular nest.
A T-Rex scatters dirt over the eggs.
It's possible that, like crocodiles, they partly covered their eggs to keep them warm.
The T-Rex suddenly sneezes and a gunky blob flies out of a nostril. It then lifts up one of its feet, revealing large shell fragments sitting amid pale yellow liquid.
For one T-Rex, a misfortune.
The T-Rex is now standing in the beams of sunlight filtering through the trees.
But for all dinosaurs, a disaster was looming.
The sky above the forest painted a luminous gold. Now the asteroid moving through space, sections of its rough pitted surface illuminated by the sun.
Deep in space, the asteroid was approaching.
Mars and the distant sun.
Its journey would take it through the orbit of our neighboring planet, Mars.
The asteroid gliding towards the planet.
Had the two collided, a catastrophe on Earth would have been avoided.
The asteroid passes in front of Mars its dark hue contrasting with the planet's burnished orange surface.
But it was not to be. And Earth's fate was sealed.
From the dark, irregular mass of rock drifting through space, to the view gliding high over the rocky, sandy terrain at the Tanis dig site.
As Robert's dig continues, his vision of what happened at Tanis is finally starting to come together. It seems the sandbank was full of life. T-Rex, Triceratops, little mammals, alongside the footprints of other dinosaurs and pterosaurs, all in a very small area.
See the scales?
I do. Oh my God.
That excites me just looking at it.
Then Robert finds something truly remarkable.
See the cracks already forming? Look at that. So we're gonna have to really monitor that before we glue it. Because this is getting vulnerable now.
An almost complete creature.
To get this block out, we're freezing it.
Robert and a colleague emerge from a tent wearing protective suits.
Robert is about to attempt something tricky.
Steady. Let's go.
To get the fossil out in one piece, they're trying to freeze it using liquid nitrogen at almost 200 degrees below zero.
They pour it from a tank over the fossil.
Watch the footing. Lauren, I'm worried about brittleness here. Okay. Get that hammer.
Yep.
Give this a couple whacks with the hammer. Okay. Move over 5 centimeters. Good. It's cracked loose. Yep.
Okay, it's loose.
So we have to get this out in one piece. One, two, three.
Yeehaw!
Total success.
Total success.
This is a technique used in archaeology for digging up human remains. We've got enough time to work with the fossil and not damage it. And I couldn't be happier.
And the creature Robert found? A turtle. This is the fossil. Now it's been cleaned up. It's lying on its side. Here's the outline of its shell. The shape of the shell and the scalloped edges here tell us that this was a bined turtle.
A turtle on a log.
Robert's bined turtle looks very similar to modern cooter turtles and lived in the same sort of freshwater environment.
The turtle splashes into calm water shaded by trees.
For a turtle, Tanis would have been ideal. Warm, shallow water. Plenty to eat.
It grazes on algae.
And lots of safe places in which to warm up in the late Cretaceous sunshine.
The little turtle basks on a tree trunk.
The turtle fossil Robert found is almost complete. This is the underside. And this brown material up here is fossilized wood. It's the end of a stick that passes right through its body and comes out just here. So the evidence points towards this turtle having been impaled. A violent end to one of the many creatures found in the crumbly rock lair at Tanis.
When I look at the animals and plants preserved in the sediments of Tanis and the footprints beneath it, I see a picture of a vibrant ecosystem, many different dinosaurs, and a thriving, thriving place.
After 10 years of digging, there is now enough evidence to piece together much of the story of Tanis and the creatures which lived here.
A Triceratops.
Robert has found so many fossils, it looks as if, even at the very end of the late Cretaceous, Tanis was bursting with life. full of the giant reptiles that had dominated the planet for more than 150 million years.
A T-Rex prepares to attack.
It's impossible to know how much longer their reign would have continued, because all this was about to end.
Winged pterosaurs on a sandy riverbank. The dark, gnarly asteroid revolves as it passes the sun on its way towards Earth. As it meets the upper atmosphere, its edge begins to glow orange. It then streaks across the sky as a ball of fire trailing smoke.
The asteroid hit.
A huge explosion.
In what is now the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. It's called the Chicxulub asteroid after the town nearest to the center of its crater.
A T-Rex strides over ground that's set ablaze. The forest fire obscures the dark silhouette of the roaring beast. A herd of long-necked herbivores progress over flat wetlands.
Any living thing within 900 miles of the impact was destroyed by the blast.
A colossal shockwave radiates from the fiery epicenter.
But what effect did the impact have on Tanis, nearly 2,000 miles away?
From the growing impact fireball from space to the team at the dig site.
To find out, Robert is looking for clues that might link Tanis to the actual day the asteroid hit.
Fragments of crumbly rock are painstakingly flicked away.
We've got some wood, and pressed up against this, and all intertangled, we've got the carcasses of fish.
Okay. That's a beautifully preserved tail. So that fish is going to be absolutely gorgeous.
So part of the detail work that we're doing right now is going in and checking out all the individual elements in this mass death layer.
Some of the evidence he's found so far has been hidden inside the fish themselves.
In more ways than one, it literally is an operation of a Cretaceous fish, so we're performing surgery on this thing.
Robert needs to open this fish's skull.
And very carefully, we want to separate this from the rest of the fish. Okay. There we go. Opening up the fish. Got a nice ant that made a home in there. And beautiful, look at that. Okay, here we have the gill bars of the fish. Those are the bars that hold the filaments of the gills. Between the gill bars, all of these clusters of round objects, those are the ejecta spherules.
Ejecta spherules are tiny balls that were once molten rock. They could be evidence of what Robert suspects, that creatures here died on the day of the asteroid strike.
Those ejecta spherules last saw the light of day when they were flying through the air 66 million years ago.
One is picked loose with a knife tip. The massive fiery impact from space.
After a large asteroid impact, a mix of vaporized and molten rock is propelled into space. There it cools, solidifying into tiny glass droplets. Some carry on deeper into space. But most are pulled back to Earth by gravity.
They rain down as shining black grains.
After a major asteroid hit, trillions of ejecta spherules would fall from the sky. Then, over millions of years, pressure and chemical reactions in the ground would turn most of them to clay. They'd look something like this. So, finding spherules in the gills of a fish, as Robert has done at Tanis, suggests the fish sucked them in while the spherules were still forming. So, these creatures could have died at the time of an asteroid impact.
Robert and his team digging.
Once Robert begins to look for ejecta spherules, he finds more and more and realizes the thick, crumbly layer of rock at Tanis is full of them.
I mean, this stuff is... Oh, my God, look at that one. These things are just gorgeous.
Ejecta spherules like this give us a fingerprint of where they came from.
If these spherules were connected to the Chicxulub impact, then the whole crumbly layer could be full of evidence of what happened on the day the asteroid hit.
That's a good one.
Oh, is that a droplet right there?
To see if that's the case, Robert needs to find a spherule that hasn't turned to clay.
Oh my God, that's a beautiful droplet.
Okay.
The small pieces of orange material that Robert and Lauren are digging up may be able to help. They're amber.
If there was anything flying through the air at that time, this is where it's going to get caught.
The amber they're collecting was once sticky resin oozing out of a late Cretaceous tree trunk. It's a way for the tree to protect itself, like a scab forming on a cut.
A black ejecta spherule lands in sticky golden amber.
Anything covered by the resin would be frozen in an amber time capsule.
The honey-like substance engulfs the round black spherule.
If they find a spherule preserved in amber, it could be analysed to see if it comes from the Chicxulub asteroid impact.
So during this batch, we were incredibly lucky that we came across two completely unaltered spherules.
This spherule could be something amazing. Evidence preserved well enough to analyze for chemical clues. If so, it could link Tanis directly with the Chicxulub impact and the last day of the dinosaurs.
The diamond light source synchrotron's futuristic circular building.
To investigate, Robert is joined at the diamond light source by Professor of Natural History, Phil Manning, of the University of Manchester. They've already run initial tests on the spherules in America.
What have you found out so far?
These little glass spherules, these globs of molten material from the impact site, have a chemical signal that ties it with where they came from. Because when an asteroid hits, it melts the ground that it hits, but also that glass has a little bit of contamination from the asteroid itself, and that gives you a unique geochemical fingerprint.
We can see once we've scanned it, and looking at spherules from other sites in North Dakota, we can get a baseline for what the ejecta should look like when it's related to the Chicxulub crater. And you can see each element here and the ratios of those elements. And when we look at Tanis, it's a match. I mean, it perfectly overlays. So I think this is powerful evidence supporting that Tanis and Chicxulub are linked.
And what do these findings mean for the rest of the fossils that you're finding in Tanis?
This data is key for the entire site, because once you have that link and you know what impact affected Tanis, then you essentially know that every object in that site, all the animals and the plants and everything buried in those sediments, are linked to the last day of the Cretaceous.
And the synchrotron here in the UK reveals something even more remarkable.
So this is showing a beautiful synchrotron scan of the half of one spherule. The glass is a good geochemical fingerprint, and we've got calcium, some iron, we've got strontium. But when we look at the entire thing, we see something quite unexpected. That's your entire spherule.
What's this?
In this, we've got a little bit of a nugget. There is a little particle right there, so we scan it, and that's a lot of iron in there. Over here, we've got chromium, a big peak in chromium. Over here, we've got a big peak in nickel. And the abundances of iron, nickel, and chromium all together That matches what you expect to see in a meteoric body. That does not match what you would normally have down here.
So this is extraterrestrial material.
If you were to sort of grind up and stuff into a spheral a piece of meteorite, that's what it's going to look like.
This could be a piece of the Chicxulub asteroid.
The piece of the bullet that killed the dinosaurs.
No.
The particle is shown as a jagged purple mass in the green spherule.
Robert could have found a fragment of the asteroid itself in Tanis. Physical evidence linking this site to the Chicxulub impact. But Tanis is almost 2,000 miles away from where the asteroid hit. So exactly how did it cause the creature's deaths?
The dig site.
To answer that question, Robert is searching in the mass death lair.
Right here, we've got this intertangled mass of fish. There's one fish here, another sturgeon goes this way underneath the body of a paddlefish. There's another sturgeon that goes this way underneath this log and continues out the other side. And his head hit that log and is deflected downward at a 90-degree angle.
Robert uncovered a tangled mass of fossilized creatures and logs surrounded by spherules and crushed together in what's known as a log jam. He has a theory that the creatures were swept to their death in some kind of turbulent surge of water and quickly entombed in sediment, which is why they're so well preserved. But what could have caused the wave?
A mosasaur swims by.
One theory is a tsunami. The asteroid hit at sea. Recent studies show it may have caused a wave almost a mile high.
The massive tsunami builds in height, with a creature just showing inside the vast wall of water.
The height of the wave would have gradually reduced as it spread across the oceans. In the late Cretaceous, North America was divided by a narrow sea that's been called the Western Interior Seaway. The tsunami could have traveled up this towards Tanis. But there's a big question about the tsunami idea. The timing.
Oh, which fish is that? That's a new contact.
Yeah.
If a tsunami killed the fish, it would have to have hit while ejector spherules were falling. Because spherules were found in the fish's gills. So how long after impact did the spherules arrive at Tanis?
Pretend this ball of foil is a piece of ejecta coming out of the crater. It would then go on an arc path, ballistic trajectory, out of the crater and to wherever it lands, in this case, Tanis. If we know the distance between myself and the landing site, and if we know the size of that ball, we can accurately calculate how long it would take to get there.
Robert types on a laptop.
The result is surprising. Robert and his team calculated that these ejector spherules landed at Tanis between 13 minutes and 2 hours after the impact. If a wave killed the fish, it must also have reached Tanis within 2 hours. Data from recent tsunamis show even a powerful one would take much longer than that to travel almost 2,000 miles from the impact site to Tanis. So, if it wasn't a tsunami, what could have caused a surge of water at Tanis?
Erlandsfjord, Norway. A grey-haired man sets out in a kayak.
Professor Stein Bondevik is an expert in tsunamis.
He paddles across dark, calm water.
The fjords in Norway are very special. We have tall mountains surrounding bodies of water, so the water is usually very calm.
In 2011, something very strange happened. the water in the fjord began to move violently.
The height of the water increased by 1.5 meter, like a maelstrom with the turbulent water. Someone said that the fjord was boiling.
News started to roll in. There'd been an earthquake 5,000 miles away in Japan.
A journalist from the local newspaper called me and he said that people were observing waves here in the fjords. I got a video clip of the waves. I saw immediately that they looked like a tsunami wave. So later in the afternoon, you can see that the fjord is perfectly calm. But at the beach here, you could see that the water is sloshing back and forth. And no one had ever seen anything like it. Some people got very upset and afraid.
A magnitude 9 earthquake had devastated the northeast of Japan around Fukushima. But how did that affect a fjord so far away?
So no one in Norway could feel the earthquake. But I could see that the times matched the arrival of the waves here in the fjord.
Eventually, Stein and his team realized that this might have something to do with seismic waves, shock waves that pass quickly through the earth during an earthquake.
So it took only 12 minutes before the first signal of the earthquake in Japan reached all the way here to Western Norway.
So it was the seismic waves that caused the normally calm water in the fjord to slosh turbulently back and forth.
Just thinking of that, scientifically, it's fantastic.
A 4x4 travels along a straight, dusty road.
Could something similar have happened in Tanis? Trying to find out is geophysicist Professor Mark Richards, who's been studying the site at Tanis for several years. He's working with Robert to discover what could have caused a surge of water here.
The large site from the air directly above.
A tsunami can't get here in less than minimum 12 hours. But seismic waves traveling from the Yucatan impact site to North Dakota can arrive here fairly quickly.
In the late Cretaceous, the Western Interior Seaway that divided North America could have been connected to Tanis through a system of rivers.
If you have a very large body of water, like the Western Interior Seaway, and you can shake it back and forth, you can generate a large water wave coming up this river at Tanis.
So seismic waves from the impact could have caused surges of water in the Tanis River system.
Seismic waves get here quickly enough, coming up the Tanis River, inundating this area, arriving at the same time these spherules are still falling out of the air.
The mystery of the wave and the thick layer of crumbly rock has been solved. Seismic waves traveling through the earth could have caused powerful surges of water at Tanis, possibly carrying mud and marine creatures like ammonites from the Western Interior Seaway, dumping them on the Tanis sandbank and burying everything at the same time as spherules fell.
A sudden torrent of water swells in a churning river.
Over millions of years, the mud would turn into the layer of crumbly rock.
And that's the beauty of Tanis. What you're seeing is a deposit that is literally recording the last, say, 45 minutes to an hour and a half of the Cretaceous.
pulling up from the large rocky area in the air. David stands in the landscape decimated by the asteroid.
If the extinction of the dinosaurs was a crime, the detectives solving it would have plenty of evidence. They would see that the asteroid was in the right place at the right time. They would see that no dinosaurs survived after the hit. They would have a piece of the murder weapon, a fragment of the asteroid. But they would be missing one very important thing, a body. No one has ever found the fossil of a dinosaur that was killed by the effects of the asteroid impact. But Robert did find part of a Triceratops in the crumbly lair at Tanis. So could that be the remains of a dinosaur that died on that day?
I'm still dubious about the horn. I kind of want to keep the horn in the jacket.
I think if you took it off, at least take this section off to see what's going on under here.
Yeah.
To find out, the team needs to establish cause of death, which can be difficult when you only have a piece of skin and a horn to go on.
This is the horn after they'd cleaned it up. The team is particularly interested in these lines here, and they found that the fractures go right through the horn. So rather than dying as a result of the impact, they wondered whether it had been killed in a fight.
Two Triceratops lock horns in a tussle.
But when they looked at the fractures in more detail, they found signs of new bone growth here, an indication that the bone had started to heal. So it looked as though the Triceratops survived the event that broke its horn. Could this Triceratops have survived until the day of the impact? The team found evidence, including sagging in the skin, which suggested that there was decay underneath. That means its body had started to rot before it was entombed and preserved by the surge. So it seems that this dinosaur didn't die as a result of the asteroid impact.
Perhaps in the months before the impact, the broken horn put the Triceratops at a disadvantage over its rivals.
Two of the huge dinosaurs stampede through a forest. The Triceratops with the injured horn arrives at a sandy riverbank, moving slowly.
And that might have led to starvation.
It settles on the ground, looking weak. Its head rests on the sand and it lies still. Lightning flashes rapidly in turbulent clouds in a yellow sky. Robert drives along the straight dirt road.
Robert has still not found direct evidence of a dinosaur that was killed by the asteroid.
We've got all these bones in the ground right now, but
the one thing that we would just dream of finding is that one dinosaur that died on the day of the impact.
Grey clouds.
And the weather isn't helping his search.
He pulls back a tarpaulin that flaps in a breeze. He kneels to examine something in a deep excavated pit.
That theropod print is toasted.
Yeah, it was in a low corner.
Look, it's full of mud and water. The problem is it's wet. Look, see, if we're not careful, we're going to lose the print. And that's the biggest theropod print we've got. I see some areas that could use glue right now, too.
The team is racing to excavate the footprints, along with dozens of fish fossils tangled together in a log jam before storms wash them away.
We're up against the clock here. The stuff that could be exposed right now is going to get ruined by the rain.
But then Robert comes across something that looks very unusual.
That's kind of... What is going on right there?
Are we sure this isn't crocodilian?
That's not crocodilian.
No.
Alright, I'm gonna try this piece right here. I'll go in from the top and then twist up and it separates on right on that line.
Oh, that's skin right there. That's actually scaly skin. No, 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 no. Look, look, look. Look at that pattern right there. Have you ever seen elongated scales like that before, Dave?
Scutellates and birds.
Just careful.
Oh, it's changing again.
It's changing again.
We're seeing it for the first time in 66 million years.
I think we've got ourselves a dinosaur.
A pattern of hexagonal scales.
A dinosaur fossil. And unlike the Triceratops, this is located in the logjam, the mass death layer, surrounded by the fish with spherules in their gills.
Removing more crumbly rock.
This is the most incredible thing that we could possibly imagine here, the best case scenario. We're excavating this mass death layer of fish from the surge sent up by the impact, and we've got dinosaur remains. The one thing that we would always want to find at this site, and here we've got it. This is unreal. I cannot process this in my brain. No, I am absolutely blown away by this. Just my heart is literally pumping out of my chest, wondering what is behind there. Just a couple centimeters back in the outcrop. What is waiting for us back there?
This is the team keeps digging.
Scales get big again over on this side.
So this could be a rib cage. It could be laying against ribs that are curved.
There's something here. That's hard.
More bone.
That's bone right next to the skin. Yeah. But that's an articular surface right there. So this is either a hip or a shoulder element.
An exposed fossilized bone.
After hours of painstaking work.
And we can go from the thigh of the animal. There's the knee. And then you've got the little calf muscles of the dinosaur. They're bulging out. And you go down to the ankle bones. And these are the toes of the feet. We've got nails at the tips of the toes. It's a beautifully preserved leg, all articulated, covered with skin.
The complete leg of a dinosaur.
In my wildest dreams, I never expected to find a dinosaur leg in this deposit.
Yeah. I mean, and then it's got skin and tissue. It does look just like a drumstick.
It looks like a Thanksgiving turkey just laid out in the ground. And this weird scale pattern on the thigh of the animal, which we've never seen in a dinosaur before.
Well, thesaurs don't have any form of defense, so they have to have camouflage or something.
That's a good point. So this could have been some sort of camouflage marking.
Yeah.
Robert thinks he has found the body in question. A dinosaur that might itself have witnessed the cataclysmic impact.
Dinosaur fossils are not known from the last years of the Cretaceous, and it was unclear whether they were already extinct or in decline or what was going on. So they were just sort of absent. And this answers that question. Were dinosaurs still there then? Well, yes. This one likely died in that surge.
The landscape under a sepia sky.
For such big claims, Robert needs verification. He's brought the dinosaur leg to London to get a second opinion.
And then here are the pads of the toes. We see all those beautiful scales lined up.
From Professor Paul Barrett, an expert in ornithischian dinosaurs from the Natural History Museum.
So what do you think this might be?
When we look at the leg, it has claws, like the claws we see in small, agile, bipedal running dinosaurs that are plant eaters. We can rule out things like Triceratops, partly just because it's not big and stocky. And the proportions of those legs are also different from some of the other plant eaters we see, in that they have this rather long ankle and shin compared with its thigh bone. So as we narrow those possibilities down, what we're left with probably is an animal called a thesaurosaur.
The small grey-brown dinosaur stands on its muscular hind legs, balanced by a long, thin tail.
Thesaurosaurs lived next to rivers where there was plenty of rich vegetation to feed on. They had leaf-shaped teeth, common amongst herbivores, and claws on their short front limbs, excellent for digging.
Another moves nimbly. Behind it, a much larger T-Rex tucks into the flesh of a Triceratops carcass. The small thessalosaur pads along the dirt with three claws on its back feet. It dips down to dig with its front limbs.
But how did Robert's thessalosaur die?
Could it have been killed by another dinosaur?
It's a possibility. This is a relatively agile animal, and that turn of speed would have been its primary defense against the large predators living alongside it.
The T-Rex is engrossed in devouring its meal.
So, to escape a hungry T-Rex, a thessalosaur's first line of defense would have been to run. But it may have had another defensive trick.
With the T-Rex hot on its tail, the thessalosaur runs along the sand, then splashes into the water.
Living next to rivers, it's possible thessalosaurs were able to swim.
The T-Rex remains on the bank while the smaller dinosaur swims away through the murky river. The sun glows above the densely packed trees around the river.
It doesn't seem to me like there is any evidence that this animal was predated. None of the obvious tooth marks or leftover bits of carnivore teeth to suggest it's been eaten.
So how do you think it died?
It didn't have any particularly nasty diseases when it died, as we can see that the bones look okay. So this is an animal that was probably living and healthy at the time that this happened to it.
Could this be a victim of the meteor strike?
I think it's entirely possible. This is actually a shoulder bone, and this bone in the living animal would actually be way over here. And similarly, this little bone here would have been from about maybe a third of the way along the tail, maybe halfway down. So somehow, these two bones have been telescoped together. Yes. So maybe this animal's been tumbled around. We've ruled out a lot of other possible causes of death for this animal. So it could well be that this is an animal that was there being tumbled around in its death throes in that river as a result of the asteroid impact.
Well, it is exactly analogous to those human bodies found in Pompeii.
It's very similar in terms of that quick entombment.
Yes, and it's almost as evocative.
That's absolutely true. You've got literally the blink of an eye at the end of the Cretaceous snapped up into history, and there it is, ready to be dug up.
Wow.
Mist drifting over a vast green canopy of trees and the sky burning with the glow from the sun. Small ferns on the forest floor.
After years of investigation, Robert has found out a great deal about the creatures which lived at Tanis. And he knows that many of them were alive on that fateful day when the asteroid devastated our planet. But how exactly did they die? Robert's finds now allow us to tell the story of that day and finally answer that question.
Dark, still water.
One of the most important days in Earth's history probably started much like any other late spring morning.
A large grey fish swimming over the riverbed.
We know the season because Robert found fossils of young fish that died at the size they reach at that time of year. This agrees with evidence already found by other scientists. Perhaps this day that would end with so much death began with something different. A new life.
A small newborn pterosaur with mousy brown fur. It has large black eyes, a curved head, and huge pointed beak. It emerges from the sand by the water. Needle-like leaves on a plant in a lush forest.
No one can be certain of the exact timings of the day when the asteroid collided with our planet. But it's estimated that within just 40 minutes of the impact, the consequences for the creatures of Tanis would have been profound.
The asteroid moving ever nearer.
Based on Robert's finds and the latest evidence from other scientists, this is how the catastrophe might have unfolded.
The asteroid is around 7 miles across, bigger than Mount Everest, and traveling at close to 45,000 miles an hour.
Its vast, fiery impact.
The impact causes an explosion bigger than a billion Hiroshima atomic bombs.
A brilliant light blazes over distant mountains, and 6 seconds tick by.
At Tanis, almost 2,000 miles away, it's completely silent.
Pterosaurs take flight.
But at the impact site, the asteroid vaporizes. More than 3 trillion tons of rock are ejected into space in a blast of superheated violence.
A mighty blast of wind.
Winds higher than 600 miles an hour. A colossal earthquake, followed by a ring of massive tsunamis.
A gigantic wall of water rises. Over 2 minutes after impact, pterosaurs are soaring over a green canopy of trees.
All the while, the creatures at Tanis go about their business.
They flap pointed wings.
Just like any other day.
Mist drifts around the trees. The pediomyid, with black and white stripes on its back and a long straight tail, scuttles along a moss-covered branch. A huge T-Rex kicks up its back leg, disturbing the dirt, then sniffs and snorts.
The evidence suggests that baby pterosaurs emerged from the egg, ready to fend for themselves. And that includes flying? Well, almost.
The small creature flaps its hairless pointed wings. The herd of long-necked herbivores.
Elsewhere, as the devastation spreads out across North America towards Tanis, dinosaurs and creatures of all shapes and sizes are obliterated by the blast.
Blazing fire and a fierce yellow glow coloring the angry smoke-filled sky. Nearing 8 minutes, and a turtle swims serenely.
At Tanis, for a few more precious minutes, life carries on as usual. But the clock is ticking.
The pediomyid skitters along the forest floor, then the two triceratops locking horns in battle. A large scaly nose sniffs the ground. The impact of the blast from space.
The blast from the impact never reaches Tanis, but seismic shock waves do.
After 13 minutes, the ground shudders around the thesaurosaur standing by the river. Dirt and stones are blasted up from the ground and land in clouds of dust.
They are far more powerful than any earthquake ever recorded.
The T-Rex stomps through the forest, and the thesaurosaur jumps into the choppy water.
The thesaurosaur might head for a place of safety.
Waves of dirt.
But seismic waves are now slowly shaking the whole region, causing water to slosh and churn.
The turtle tumbles through the murky water.
At Tanis, strange currents in the river give a hint of what is still to come.
The thesaurosaur struggles in the river current, while the body of the Triceratops still lies on the riverbank.
Next, it begins to rain. Ejector spherules are falling back to Earth.
Nearing 18 minutes past the impact, and the dark spherules rain down through clouds of smoke and fire.
As the spherules begin their fall, friction heats them until they're red hot.
The small bead of rock glows bright orange, then darkens.
Then the heat transfers to the air. Temperatures rise with every second.
Wisps of smoke dance over sizzling rocks. The T-Rex stumbles.
As the heat builds, the creatures of Tanis are fighting for their lives.
the Earth from space.
And then, as seismic waves continue to slowly rock the whole region,
the churning Forest River.
A violent surge wave, 10 meters high, rushes up the Tanis River.
After 28 minutes, the wave slams into the riverbank. Dinosaurs are swept away by the water blast. The powerful wave spreads, covering the vast dry landscape with murky, frothing water and engulfing the forest.
Surviving the turbulence of the surge is a challenge even for the best swimmers.
The thesaurosaur paddles its powerful back legs while lifting its small head above the water. A turtle beside it is swept backwards.
Then the powerful rocking of the river system slowly begins to draw the water back the way it came.
Muddy water drifts over fallen trees. The clock ticks to half an hour, and the thesaurosaur's body is now buried in the sand.
Swimming may have saved the thesaurosaur in the past, but not this time.
Its bent leg is exposed.
A large, robust animal like a T-Rex might have survived the surge.
Black ejector spherules rain down.
As might a hard-shelled reptile. But there is much more to come. As billions of tons of superheated spherules continue to fall, the atmosphere gets even hotter, igniting dead leaves and sparking wildfires.
A blazing red inferno and black smoke engulfing the trees.
Earthquakes. Fire. Devastation. Little would survive for long. On land,
a mighty T-Rex is surrounded by flames.
Or in the air,
a pointed-winged pterosaur falls from the sky, smashing into a tall tree before slamming down to the forest floor. Its sharp beak tilts back as its body goes still. Plumes of smoke rise into the air while the blaze continues to scorch the earth.
As the air reaches the temperature of an industrial oven, those that live deep underground may have a better chance.
The pediomyid in a burrow underground watches the flames outside.
As the slow sloshing of the river system continues, another powerful surge hits.
As the clock ticks on to 34 minutes, a flood of brown water swells over the forest, covering it completely. The water erupts over the dirt.
There is no escaping the destruction.
The turtle struggles in the current.
For many of the creatures of Tanis, their stories end underwater.
It's swept back and is impaled on a small branch. A cloud of red blood drifts from its body. The destroyed muddy riverbed and trees from above.
In less than 2 hours, the world has changed forever.
The landscape revolves until it's completely transformed with layers of dirt.
The mud the surge waves leave behind will gradually turn into the thick layer of crumbly rock entombing the creatures which died here. Until 66 million years later, when they're finally unearthed.
The excavation site from above. David sitting on a rock in a barren, scorched landscape.
Robert's finds have helped us understand in remarkable detail what happened at Tanis in the minutes after the asteroid impact. But what about the rest of the world?
The impact triggered catastrophic events such as earthquakes all over the planet. And as spherules continued to fall, Wildfires may have sprung up around the globe. As that horrific day drew to a close, many of the world's dinosaurs were already dead.
The destroyed, blackened environment.
Research shows that the angle at which the asteroid hit and the sulfur-rich rocks at the impact site amplified the devastation. Billions of tons of sulfur were ejected into the atmosphere, blocking the sunlight.
Without light, most plants died, and food became scarce. As the weeks and months passed, any dinosaur left alive would have died of hunger. In the oceans, it was the same. Nearly all of the world's plankton disappeared, leading to the starvation of most marine creatures.
It's thought that the nuclear winter that followed caused a global temperature drop of at least 25 degrees centigrade. The fossil record tells us that this huge change in climate marked the disappearance of three-quarters of all species, including the dinosaurs.
The planet was in semi-darkness for around a decade as dust and soot slowly fell to Earth. But then came something wonderful. A new beginning.
Plant life emerging.
Once the dust cleared from the atmosphere and the sunlight returned, plant life was gradually restored, led by ferns, the spores of which had lain dormant deep underground. And the world began to turn green once more. But what about the animals? Back at Tanis, Robert has unearthed something that could have helped save some of the creatures from the devastating fires.
We saw a little thing poking out, so we kind of followed it back. And I'm so glad that we did, because what we have here is a fossil burrow from an animal 66 million years ago. The only animals that would have been around back then that would likely build a burrow like this would be the small mammals, roughly ferret-sized, and also some reptiles. If it is from a mammal, this is sort of a window into the lifestyle of some of our oldest ancestors out here. This guy would have burrowed sideways right into the riverbank. We actually have some scratch marks on there from the interior when they were digging it. Going back, and he would have lived back here and sought shelter from the dinosaurs because they just did not want to get eaten.
Burrows are part of the reason that mammals survived the Great Extinction. During the nuclear winter, a burrow would have provided warmth, protection, and a place to store food. Mammals that survived were resourceful omnivores, and insects would have been a plentiful source of food. And they had another advantage, their size.
If conditions are right, many animal species get larger as they evolve over millions of years. Take T-Rex as an example. This is a cast of the lower jaw of a predecessor called Gorgosaurus, which lived 72 million years ago. Whereas this is the cast of the lower jaw of a T-Rex, which lived 5 million years later. Look at the difference in size. But the bigger the creature, the more energy they need to stay alive. So when catastrophe strikes and food is scarce, the largest tend to die out, whilst the smallest often survive.
That's one of the reasons why many of the smaller mammals lived through the Great Darkness. And they weren't alone. Robert's fossil turtle may have been unlucky, but many others survived. as did crocodiles, snakes, and many fish species.
And as for the dinosaurs, did the impact really kill them all? Well, this beautiful fossilized feather isn't from a bird, but from a predatory dinosaur. So we have to be careful when we say that dinosaurs are extinct, because what we call birds originally evolved from the smallest feathered dinosaurs. So to be correct, we should say all non-avian dinosaurs are extinct. Robert's finds have given us a better idea than ever before about what happened on the day that led to the extinction of the largest beasts ever to walk the earth.
Dinosaurs were perhaps some of nature's most extraordinary creatures, dominating the planet for over 150 million years before they became extinct. But extinction comes in different forms, and many of the amazing creatures and plants alive today are also threatened. It's possible that humanity is having as big an impact on the world as the asteroid that ended the age of the dinosaurs. As human beings, we are unique in our ability to learn from the distant past. Now, we must use that ability wisely and do our very best to protect the millions of species for whom, alongside us, this planet is home.
Pterosaurs, with their long, sharp beaks and wide, hairless wings, glide over the lush green forest canopy while the sun reflects on the glass-like river.